Speaking of what she, her choices and her activist choices, she chose to go into law and mm-hmm. and concentrated on particular areas of law. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. Actually, law was the career of choice for these new women of the 1910s. They wanted to change the laws to benefit women and also benefit children. They sought that as part of women's issues. Like I said, forget about going to Yale, Harvard, almost any other law school in the country. The most welcoming law school in the country was New York University. So she did end up going there. I should say she got terrible grades. She got D's, let's see, an F in civil procedure, which I'm sure was totally dull to her. Her only A was in pleading. And, of course, that's what she was so good at, you know, sort of being, speaking to crowds, et cetera. And the idea was that she wanted to use the law, use the system to make the world a better place for give more opportunities to women and to children's rights, too. That was not unusual for women. She had some role models. Crystal Eastman, who was Max's sister, and also was going to go on to be a real leader among women lawyers, had gone to NYU University Law School a little before her. There were a few others that she was friends with. And, you know, she knew constitutional law pretty well. She once led a bunch of suffragists into their local senator's office, and he started saying, oh, it's too soon for women to have the vote, and she was well capable of parrying him about constitutional law, and, you know, what it did say and what it didn't say. She also, interestingly enough, faced some discrimination in the field, as you can imagine, as all women lawyers did when she finally passed the bar. She worked for a criminal lawyer, James Osborne, and she was very interested also, too, in protecting anybody of any sex who she felt was a victim of the system. She thought a lot of people, men who went to jail, were victims of their environment, of poverty. They didn't have sufficient education. I think at one point she says that, you know, 80% of all convicts would be perfectly fine if they just had educational opportunities and some education. So she wanted to be a criminal lawyer, defend them. Well, not much room for women in that field. Even in the firm that she's working for, at one point there's a big libel case in Buffalo. And everybody else in the firm went, but she was not allowed to go because she was female. And, of course, it would just be too scandalous if this single woman went off, you know, out of town on an overnight trip with the male staff members. So that was one example of discrimination she received. You know, other women lawyers, it wasn't considered feminine for them to be talking in the court. It was considered too dangerous for them to go out and serve subpoenas to people. Agnes did do a bit of that. And the criminal lawyer she worked for was pretty supportive. She would go into the tombs with him to interview clients. She helped him defend, not officially, but she helped him defend two or three murderers who were acquitted. And then after she got her degree at NYU, was part of a research commission on conditions at Sing Sing. And she actually went in there and was helping to interview convicts in Sing Sing, which is quite unusual. And the report that they came up with was responsible for the eventual closing of Sing Sing, but also really improving conditions at that prison and other New York State prisons. Among the radical causes of this crowd is prison reform, rehabilitation in prison, not just punishment, and against capital punishment, too. It was seen as inhumane.
That's right. She was very much involved in taking up some death penalty cases and fighting them.
Yes, and she actually wasn't officially representing one. The one that's most famous involved a slightly retarded man named Charles Stilo, who was accused of killing two people in upstate New York. And she was convinced that he, at first she was convinced he was innocent, but regardless, she felt that to take a mentally retarded man and kill him was absolute cruelty on the part of the state, absolutely barbaric and wrong. And so she did a lot of research to try to find evidence to free this man, as did a couple of other female lawyers. Charles Stilo became quite a cause célèbre among the New York City female lawyers. And she also did a lot of publicity. They had a big rally in his hometown, home county, to sort of get a petition going to ask the governor to cancel his or stay his death sentence, which happened two or three times. And ultimately, he's going to go on death row. And many years later, he actually will be exonerated of the crime. And Inez is partly responsible for that.
So it seems like her life fits into the mold of post-1960s feminism.
As did many radicals of the 1910s, which is, this is my favorite decade. There's nothing that anybody did in the 1960s, with the exception of perhaps LSD, because it wasn't around, that young radicals weren't doing in Greenwich Village in the 1910s. It was just an amazing crowd. If I could pick another decade and place to live, it would be Greenwich Village in the 1910s. You know, they worked hard and they played hard. Emma Goldman, who was once said, you know, if I can't dance, I don't want your revolution. They were idealistic. They were fiery. But perhaps not as good at sticking to things, you know, as they could be. But they were always fighting for the side of right. And, of course, World War One is about to end the party. This idealistic young group, you know, this is the age before World War One, where people think, you know, science is booming. People are educated. If we just educate people about problems with the slums, about racism, about, you know, women should be able to vote, that'll solve all the problems once it's just pointed out to people. And, of course, World War One is going to come crashing in on the idealism and is going to quash a lot of dreams for these folks who really, they really think at this time that they can fix anything. It just takes enough talk, maybe takes enough clubs, enough rallies, and they can fix the problems, and life is just going to get better and better. So it's very, if you read any of these accounts of these folks in the 1910s, they're smart, they're brave, you know, they're idealistic, and they're a little outrageous. You know, they have a lot of fun.
And they're a lot outrageous.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. They used to have, Liberal Club in Greenwich Village was one of their hangouts, and below it was Polly's Restaurant. And that's where they all hung out. And they were famous for having all sorts of wild parties. And one of them was they had sort of these pagan rituals. And people would dress up as fairies and, wood nymphs and things like that. You know, and it was quite a bacchanal and a lot of liaisons began. There were some married couples in the group. But they really, they saw the shortcomings of traditional marriage. And they almost all got married. Instead of abandoning marriage, they were sure they could transform it. And so some of these couples experimented with open marriage, which we think of as a much more, you know, modern thing. It turned out it was harder than they thought it might be. And it wasn't just because they were libertines. I mean, they really thought that people, very idealistic, people shouldn't be together unless it was their own free will, you know, free love. And that a couple should be trying to be supportive of the other and give them as much freedom as possible. This being in the 1910s and probably even today, this benefited the men a lot more than the women, you know, and that proved a lot more problematic. But as I look back at them, and you got to give them a lot of, you know, credit for trying to improve things that are still thorny issues for us. You know, how do you have an intimate relationship and not kill individuality? They took these things to heart and really tried to blaze a new way to live. And I, you know, you can criticize them. They were, you know, sort of hypocrites at some point. Things didn't, you know, work out in some ways. They didn't totally change the world, but they are the moderns. America's going to change partly because of these people and their new views, new questioning views, open views. They're more sensual. It's very easy for me to really over-romanticize them. You know? Mm-hmm. They weren't perfect, but they certainly were fascinating.
As you point out, World War One puts an end to a lot of this experimentation, a lot of this cultural innovation. Mm-hmm. How does World War One affect Inez's life?
Well, one, it's going to affect her family because this lovely four-story brownstone near Kensington Palace that they've owned for the last more than a decade, they're going to have to leave London because, of course, the war is going to start there. It was 1914, and so they're going to have to abandon that. And her father, Kensington Gardens, he used, in his diaries, which actually are up at the Ticonderoga Historical Society, 20 years of his diaries, he's often talking about the flowers that are blooming in Kensington Gardens. Well, that's now a camp for soldiers, and they're training there. So that's all changing. So they have to leave England. There's more repression on this group. Her ex-boyfriend Max Eastman's magazine, The Masses, is going to be among 30 or so banned by the Postmaster General, just because it questions whether the war is the correct path. She also is, she's going to join the Women's Peace Party along with Jane Addams and Crystal Eastman. And something else about these feminists, at this time, they really think that women are morally superior to men in the sense because they create life, and they truly believe World War I would never have happened if women voted. And so this actually becomes one of their arguments for women voting, because women are pacifists. They would never kill life because they create it. So Inez is involved in that. And then her law career is not going real well, partly because she's facing discrimination, partly because she's kind of a dilettante. For instance, after she comes off this big Sing Sing prison investigation, which really is unusual for a woman, could have been a stepping stone to something big, she decides it's time to go off for her annual summer vacation in London and Paris and to go to all the dances. So, you know, she's kind of a dilettante. But she's worried now, a couple years later, that she has to get her career online. Work is the most important thing in the world to her, even if she is diverted from it a few times. And another old boyfriend, it was this Guglielmo Billy Marconi, to whom she was the inventor of the wireless. They were engaged for a few months back when she was a teenager, has been called by his government to get the wireless in operation because Italy's just entered the war in 1915. And Inez is, she's still looking to make her mark. Law's not working out too well, so she decides to go over to Italy with him and become a reporter. Only two or three women have done this in the past. It's probably the ultimate, you know, male terrain, the battlefield. So she goes over, and she has a tough time of it. They won't let her on to the front because she's a woman. She doesn't like the bed bugs biting her and the smells in Italy. And she's really not a trained reporter. She's done some writing for McClure's magazine, mainly about the women's movement and about free love. So we have this objective ideal, supposedly, for journalists that you stick to the facts. And all the stories that she sends back to the New York Tribune end up being sort of these diatribes against war and how foolish the Italians are and how it's... And then she goes into this purple prose about how Italy's women would not let this happen. But that's a new adventure for her, so that's a big step. Once again, it's... You know, it's got its good points and bad points. You have to have a lot of courage to be a woman to go to battle in 1915. This is before we're in the war. Only two or three women have done it. One is Mary Reinhart, who's going to be writing for the Saturday Evening Post, and who probably inspired Inez to go over there. 10 million people are reading the Saturday Evening Post a week by then, and Reinhart actually is going to get to the front and talk about being in no man's land, you know, between the two trenches, etc. And Inez probably thinks that she can do that too, but she's not. So she's gonna once again come back and feel that she's failed again.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, Professor Lumsden. So let's take the story to the end of her life. And these are the final years in the struggle for the vote for women, and she is very much involved in that, is she not?
Yeah, and actually she's the only martyr for the suffrage in America. In 1916, she's going to go on once again to try to make her mark. She's been persuaded by Alice Paul to go on this Western campaign against Woodrow Wilson because women vote in the West, about 4 million of them, and so the voteless women of the East, a few of them are going to go and stump camp against Wilson for votes for women. Inez is not feeling so well. She agrees to go. She's married at this point. Her husband and she have had lots of troubles, including affairs she's had while she was in Italy, etc. But she decides to go. Her father wants her to go because he envisions once women get the vote, she might be New York's first congresswoman. So she goes and stumps across the West back in 1916, is exhausted. Turns out she has pernicious anemia. Every place she goes in the West, people turn out, standing room only crowds, cheer her, love her. She rallies herself to give these great speeches about how it's women for women. You know, vote against Wilson because the Democrats have not come out formally for women's vote. And meanwhile, every time she gives a speech, she goes back to her hotel room and collapses. In Los Angeles, she's going to collapse in mid-speech, supposedly, as she's saying, "Mr. President, how much longer must women wait for liberty?" She's going to linger for the next month. And when she dies, she's going to be editorialized as a martyr for women's rights across the country. Carl Sandburg's going to write a poem about her. And the militant suffragists, led by Alice Paul, a small but vocal group, are going to take her name and show up at Wilson's house, his White House, and say, "Mr. President, you know, don't let Inez Milholland die in vain. Please come out for the suffrage amendment." He won't, and so the next day they're going to start picketing the White House. And that's the beginning of 2 years of public protests. Many of them in Inez's name, these pickets, one of their banners is going to say, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?" Sometime later, on her birthday, August 6th, 40 women will climb the Lafayette Monument on her birthday, read Wilson's speeches, and say he's a hypocrite for talking about democracy when half of the Americans can't vote. 168 of those women who picket the White House and are involved in those protests are going to go to jail. Alice Paul is going to go on a hunger strike. She's going to be force-fed, one of the very few times this ever happened in America, and they're going to send in a psychiatrist to try to secretly declare her insane and then lock her up. And after listening to her for 2 hours, he's convinced she's totally sane. And finally, the more conservative suffragists have worked for the war, the knitting and things like that for the Red Cross. These vocal suffragists in Inez Milholland's name, led by Alice Paul, are going to be making a lot of noise. Wilson finally is going to want to get them off his back. He's going to come out for the suffrage amendment. And finally, by August 26, 1920, the 19th Amendment granting women the right to vote will be added to the Constitution.
It strikes me that this period, the teens, we were talking about how similar the feminists of the teens were to the post-1960s feminists.
Yeah.
So too is the period as a whole. I sort of, there's the same type of cultural reaction that unfolds after the decade of the teens, similar to the type of reaction that occurred in the 70s and 80s to the 1960s. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, it's striking, isn't it? And I just wonder if this is cyclical, if you have, you know, a decade of openness and change and experimentation, if it just becomes too much for society and you have these more conservative forces come along and shut it down. Of course, World War I opens the door for all sorts of censorship. And the government is going to play a role, not just in the suffragists, but the socialists, all these different groups that had, you know, new ideas about how perhaps make our society a little more equitable for everybody. They're going to be so harassed by the government, the Palmer raids, you know, the Red Scare, that a lot of those folks aren't going to be able to function. Eugene Debs, of course, in 1916 is going to campaign as president of the Socialist Party for president of the United States from jail. And he's going to get 6% of the vote. But again, he's in jail. By the 1920s, the government and the results of people have been scared by World War I. People are a lot more receptive to intimidation. A lot of those people are going to be silenced. Emma Goldman is going to be deported, sent back to Russia. Women are going to, one, figure in 1920, they win the vote. It's time for us, okay, fine, everything's solved now. Let's go have our careers. Or two, they're also going to be tired of working as a group and being political, and they're ready to have some fun. In the 1920s, the new woman is the flapper. You know, she's not marching in parades, but she's smoking cigarettes, she's dancing the Charleston. And so that gets a lot more frivolous, and a lot of these choices they talked about are sort of become commodified. You know, choice on who you vote for becomes choice what lipstick do you choose? And another factor is some people are just going to say, you know, women should not be out at all. Women should be back in the home. There's going to be more of a push for women to become domestic again. And that, of course, will get a big push in the 1930s during the Depression when, you know, economics makes the world go round, when it's, a married woman is seen as having the extra job, you know, give men the jobs. They're the breadwinners. So, yeah, there are a lot of parallels, and it's reflected in the media. And that's going to continue, again, through World War II. Again, women will be called back into the factories because war demands it. And then after the 50s, when they're no longer so needed, the culture is going to, you know, call them back to the home. But women are restless by then, you know, and it won't be till you see Betty Friedan, who's, you know, the feminine mystique in the early 60s, and other people are going to, again, like women already did in the 1910s, question these rigid gender roles. You know, why do women have to be cooking? Why do women have sole responsibility for the children? Why can't a woman work in an office? Why can't a woman go to law school? And this is my generation. You know, it was interesting to me to find out that, well, there had been a whole generation of women who had raised these questions, fought this battle 50 years ago. And one consequence of this culture tightening up on them and, you know, regaining control over their story was that they disappeared from history. And one aspect of the women's movement in the 1970s was really this flowering of women's history. It's the reason why I even wrote this book, because I was educated in graduate school by women who were the first women's historians of the 1970s who started rediscovering people like Alice Paul, like Sojourner Truth. And, you know, it's like Inez Milholland, who, again, has been forgotten now by almost anybody, or almost everybody, but was really the most glamorous, most celebrated suffragist, female activist of the 1910s.
I'm curious about one last thing, and that is when I asked you about what drew you to this story, I was wondering if one of the things that drew you, you being a professor of journalism and broadcasting, was the role of the press in creating the persona of the new woman and the persona of Inez.
Yeah, so it really was. That was fascinating to me that, you know, if you were to look at, let's say, coverage of Gloria Steinem, okay, in the 1960s and 70s, who's a little bit analogous to Inez. She was the glamour girl. She was criticized a lot. Inez was not. I mean, I can think of one or two instances. The press just loved her. This is about the time that the press, of course, which is the, you know, the mass media then, maybe magazines, but there's no radio, there's no TV. The only timely news medium is newspapers. They have a lot of power. They're just sort of lurching into this love affair with celebrity. This is really the first decade you can reproduce photographs in the newspaper, and you start having these really lovely sections of photographs, society sections, and you're running photographs of famous actresses, et cetera. And you can sort of make a name for yourself just by being sort of glamorous, you know, being a celebrity. Okay, what do you really do? But they love that. And interesting, too, the way they sort of constructed this public persona, you know, that she was an Amazon, that she was invincible. They protected her in a way. I mean, they knew she was kind of self-indulgent. They knew she was really rich. I'm not sure they knew she was totally financially dependent on her father for all this, even though she epitomized the independent new woman. They just didn't really cover any of that. I'm not sure why. I don't think a woman could get away with that now, maybe because there's more media and everybody's gotten a little more savvy, a little more jaded. But at the time, boy, she's... I still don't quite understand it, why she got such a free ride. Part of it was she looked just like the Gibson girl, and that's another interesting, you know, case of the media sort of constructing the ideal woman who in the 1910s, if you've ever seen a print of her, had long flowing hair. Her hair is down, very different from Victorian woman. She's always in motion. She's on a bicycle. She's playing tennis, very different, again, from the Victorian woman. And she's kind of a flirt if you look at these pictures. And she's very independent, a little bit sassy. And Inez looked the part. And the whole country was smitten with that image of this young, independent, of course, always attractive. I should also add, always, you know, in Inez's case, white, rich, well-educated, you know, heterosexual. But that's sort of the ideal of what the American girl is these days.
Professor Lumsden, thank you very much for taking the time and participating in Talking History. And for those in the listening audience who want to know more about the life and times of Inez Mulholland, and there's a lot more to know, you might check out the book by the title, Inez, The Life and Times of Inez Mulholland. Well, thank you again.
Thank you, Gerald. I enjoyed it.